This talk was given by Linda Shinji Hoffman at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shinji is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, all of you and you all at home on one continuous thread. I wish I could see you like you can see us. Wendell Berry, the farmer, poet, writer, wrote these words. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. I've heard this idea of not knowing for a long time. When my partner Blaze turned 50, I made a cake for him and I wrote on it, "Only don't know." And then when he turned 51, I made another cake and wrote, "Still don't know." And now he's turning 74. Every day, this edge of not knowing is offered to us. Every moment is completely open for the next step we take, the next thought we think, and the next words we say. And this is how we create our life. That simply. Not knowing is being present, fully, absolutely present, with nothing excluded and no gaps. We have to be alive and awake. I imagine some of you are sitting with questions, some of them large, questions that we can't think our way out of, because if we try to think our way, there's just too many sides and complexities, and it becomes an equation when, at least in my experience, we're really looking for that one true answer, that one true path, the one way of becoming, that way to fulfill our vows. I think we do know the answers, that true answer, but it does take time and quiet for that truth of our knowing to surface. And it takes trust. We need to have so much trust in ourselves. I had a big question, and I asked my mother when she wasn't well. I think we both knew she was dying. And she just said, just keep asking the questions. Like she trusted me that much. She knew I would find my way. So this I don't know is a powerful doorway. And it opens and it offers us a different way of holding the world. Because we're then asking questions without holding on, without reaching for an answer, without needing an answer. We become more and more ourselves, empty of anything permanent, empty of anything that we need to hang on to. coming and going like the Tathagata Buddha, at ease and free. There's a collection of Christian mystical writings by an anonymous author, and the title is The Cloud of Unknowing. And the teachings point out that the spiritual path to God is not through the intellect, not through the rational mind, but through surrender into the dark silence of unknowing. In Zen, we have that too. The koan where the monk is asks his teacher, "What do you think about all that time?" And the teacher says, "I think not knowing, not thinking, I don't know, unknowing." In session, we're exploring questions, but we're not even really aware of it. Those big ones, who am I? Why am I here? Hogen Sensei talked about them yesterday. We don't really look for the answers. We allow our mind to disengage, to get rid of our agenda, to just be simple, to be kind, to be at ease. We become our sitting, just long hours of sitting. We don't really know what this sitting is. What is Zazen? A way to study our mind, a way to calm our mind, but what is it really? We can only experience it, sitting moment to moment, hour to hour, day after day. We don't know. But if I'm asked, why do I go to session? I think the truest answer is because it fills me with gratitude and cracks open my heart. That's what session does. And we don't know why, but we don't need to know why. The Korean Zen master Seong Sang wrote a book, Only Don't Know. And I think that's really where I found the line from so long ago. And in the book, it's a series of letters, real letters with real questions that his students wrote to him and he answered. And I kind of looked through the book and there was a story in it about from a student who was actually, in fact, a teacher. And he wrote to Seong Sung saying he was going to return his robe and bowl. And he said he was sad, but he had to do this because it wasn't working for him. And Seong Sung wrote back that he was also sad. And he reminded him of a story that this person had once told. And it's a story that you'll see, it just grabbed me because it's about a bear. And this bear is in the wild. And this bear happily goes about finding fish to eat and berries to pick and whatever else the bears are eating at that time of year. And sometimes the bears are hungry, this bear in particular, and sometimes this bear is full. But what happens is that some men come and capture the bear, and they put him in a cage, and they sell him to a circus. And the bear learns to do circus tricks. And the bear does a somersault forward and then gets a treat. And the bear does a somersault backwards and gets a treat. And the bear does all these tricks so well, the bear is well fed. And this goes on for several years. And the bear is very happy in its tiny little cage. It knows it very well, but this is all it knows now. Until one night, vandals come and open up every cage in the circus. And the bear escapes and finds itself, himself, herself, back in the mountains and doesn't know what to quite do. So at one point, the bear begins to do forward somersaults and then backward somersaults. And the other bears come over and say, "What are you doing?" And they just say, "You knucklehead, you can't." Oh, he has to tell them first. "Well, I'm doing this to get my food." And they say, "You knucklehead, you know, you can't get food that way. You're in the mountains now." But he's forgotten. He thinks he's still in his little cage. And it was such a vivid story for me to think of, wow, what are my cages? And what are my habits that I repeat in my cage? And how do we get out of that cage? So that bear didn't remember what it was like to be free or how to be free. And Seong Sung continued his letter to the student and just said how we create cages for ourselves, whatever it is, our identities. I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a Zen student. But Seong Sung said to him in his letter, "I want to break down your cage and make you completely free. You're just reinforcing your cage, making it stronger with your sense of me, mine, and I." And Seong Sung urged him not to hold on to anything. "Don't make anything," he said. "Don't make complications, or you have complications. When you don't make anything, your mind is empty, then nothing will be a hindrance." So if we're free when we don't know, when our heart is open, how do we open our heart? How do we find this way to not know? And there's a fascicle by Dogen that I think we studied not too long ago, but it's the four bodhisattva methods of guidance. And I guess because there's just four, I find it helpful. Well, actually, there's 16 because the four have the four inside, but you only have to remember four. And they're called the four guidances, but I've also heard them called the four embraces, which I think is a beautiful way to describe, because these are four guidances on how to relate to others, to other people, because of course that's where the afflictions arise. And so these four, generosity is the first. And we're all pretty familiar with generosity. I think it's the easiest one. I think it's in a way the simplest, the paramita also, generosity. We let go of our grasping, we open our hand and offer. We offer whatever is needed. We offer either a It could be material things, but more than that, we offer our presence. We offer our presence. We can offer silence that doesn't exist. So much in this world today. When we listen to someone and don't respond, we hold that silence with them, with them. Shugen Roshi once said in a talk, and I always remember, that you can feel someone who's generous just by the way they walk in the room. So generosity is the first. Loving speech is the second. So before speaking, we consider whether our words are true, useful, and timely. Will they actually be heard? Will they have a good effect? They're, of course, not words that make us feel good. They're words that are helpful to someone else. Dogen writes, "Loving speech means, first of all, to arouse compassionate mind when meeting with living beings and to offer caring and loving words. We should study how loving speech has the power to transform the world." That's Dogen. Beneficial action is the third. So beneficial action is just really what it says, actions that are beneficial. It's an act of oneness because we benefit self and other together. It's how we harmonize with the world. And it's through our actions. So you see, these are building. Dogen writes, beneficial action is the whole of the Dharma. It benefits both self and other widely. We should equally benefit friends and enemies alike, he says. Friends and enemies alike. If you have this heart, even beneficial action for the sake of grass, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. Thus, we benefit friend and enemy equally, self and other alike. And the fourth is identity action. We're all here together. And it is to be not different, non-difference between self and other. We have to act from a place of common ground, common identity, to benefit the other. And I think this is where it gets more difficult, because it's not always easy if we don't share the same views. So on Thursday morning, so Thursday, we came together on Monday, just a few days before I came here with you all. That's what I'm kind of leading up to. I took our two dogs for a walk. One of them is not ours. One is Maggie May, a rescue from Georgia. Eugen has met her. And the other is my daughter's dog. And he's actually made it into a talk of mine before. He's another rescue. And we were all wearing orange vests because it's both deer hunting season, bow deer hunting season, and duck hunting season in the abutting conservation area where we walk. And on our way to the woods, we go over a little footbridge. And then there's a field, and this is the field where there's a lot of sculpture, where we have an outdoor sculpture exhibit at our farm. And we're kind of coming around and leading up to where there's a big sculpture of mine. It's bronze, and it's called the Healing Harp. And it's like a tree that is grown like this, like almost like ram's horns. But it's actually a healing pattern. That's why I call it the healing harp, of the way a tree grows when it's attacked by a fungus. And so we're walking towards that sculpture, and the dogs stop, and I stop. They're off leash. And suddenly, from behind the sculpture, this 8-point buck stands up, and he's 15 feet from us. And the dogs don't bark, which was very odd. And he just stares. And then Theo can't wait. So he like starts approaching. And the buck doesn't know what to do, it seems like. But he turns, and the only thing he could do was skirt along the pond edge. But what he does is he steps into the water and he swims. He swims slowly across the pond to the other shore. And I can see as he's getting out of the water, he just stands. He doesn't like go up on land. He rises up and stands. And then he walks a few steps and he lays down, with just his head up, like keeping track of us, because we're over here. And that's when I know that this buck has come here to die. Like, I can just tell. Like, this is not normal behavior for a duck, for a buck. And all I want to do is go over there and see this animal. But I needed to take the dogs for a walk. And so that's what I decide to do. I mean, I leave him be, and off we go. But it's really, we're very rattled, all three of us, from seeing this buck in this strange way. And so we get into the woods, the conservation land, and I'm going one direction, and then Theo's taking off, and I have to call him back, and taking off again, and I call him back, and it just doesn't feel good. So then I decide to go back, take another turn, go a different way, and then we're heading back to the farm, and then I decide I'm not going to go the normal way. I'm going to go this other way. I mean, it's just like I'm so certain I'm going to do these things. And I go this other way, and then I look up on the hill, and there is a hunter. And he is in full garb. Like, you just, when you see someone all outfitted with a compound bow and arrows in the back, and it's scary. And I have worked for years now to create a different relationship with hunters. And so when I see them in the woods, which happens during hunting season every year, I will engage them or go up to them or try to like have a conversation. And usually they are just out there to really walk around, because it's rare that you actually get a buck, it turns out. But I see this hunter, and he doesn't see us. And we're all in flagging and two loose dogs. And so I call out, "Hello." And he doesn't answer, like he is in his own zone. And so I say, "Did you just shoot a buck?" And he says, "Did you see it? Do you know where it is?" So I guess this keep thinking of this identity action, like this is where I am. And so I wasn't thinking of identity action, but I said, I did see it. And I said, he's at our house. And I knew that was a little odd, like he's not at the front door. But I think I wanted him to know that this was something that was personal. Like he had done something that had made this affect me and it would affect my family. So I said, I can take you to him. So I put the two dogs on the leash, and then he mentioned that he had someone with him who was helping him track the deer somewhere else. And I said, well, you should call him. And he called him. And then I headed back. I put the dogs in the house, and I met them both, these two men. And I took them to where they could see the deer laying, but they could just really see the rack and his head. And it was kind of turning a little, like you knew he was alive. And, I mean, I had already told the hunter that I would take him there, but that he couldn't shoot him, that I wanted the buck to die on his own. I mean, I just couldn't imagine more shooting. So he saw the buck, and I could feel like all he wanted to do was just go get it. And so a little more conversation, and he knew, because I had said he could have the deer. I mean, he could have the meat. But I didn't want him to, like, drag the... He had to wait. We had to do this in a good way, somehow, make something good of it. So talked with the hunter and his friend. They would go off and get their car and meet back here at the house. Their car was at the other side of the woods. And so I was going back up towards the house, and I met Blaze, my partner, who was there now, and Issa, our farmer. And I wanted them to see the deer and to see the deer laying down. So I took them to this other, like, vantage point so they could see the deer. And we stood there, and we watched as suddenly the deer started, like, reaching up with the two hooves, reach up, and then he just, like, fall. And he'd do that again. He'd throw himself up, and then he'd fall. And he did that a few more times until he just lay. His head didn't rise again. So it was that we watched him die. He was leaving his body. Somehow that was the... And then Issa, I don't know who said, let's say a prayer. So from where we were, Issa started saying a prayer, and Issa's from Chile, so it was in Spanish. And it was just, it was so beautiful to stand there then. But then I saw them, and so I had to run over because I wanted to get to the buck before, I didn't want them to start dragging him out of the grasses and stuff. And I ran as fast as I could down there, and they said he died. And I said, we know, which was really, I was so grateful that he died, you know, not a long time. I had found out that, he had actually been hit in the liver, called a, I can't remember what they call it, something to the gut, but it's not to the lung, where I guess a deer dies very quickly. And so anyway, I got over there and I said, no, you can't take him right now. We need to spend some time with him. And so we did. So Issa and Blaze and the hunter, and his hunters Alex and friend Jason, and we all gathered there around this buck who's lying like on his side, hooves out, head. The wound was down, so you couldn't see it. And I sat down by his head and looked in his big brown eye that was just bright. And I put my hand like on him. I couldn't believe that I just had to. And then I like pushed my hand into this beautiful silvery fur, like you would like in a dog that has just so much fur. I don't know, I wanted to know if there was movement or something, but I felt like I was just breathing this buck into me and taking him. So after, I just want to share that the Jason, the other hunter who was actually teaching him, said, as we were all together around this buck, said that was really beautiful. He said, I've never had such a beautiful experience. And so I could only think that and hope that maybe the hunter will also remember this experience. Maybe the next time he shoots an animal, but maybe he would do it with a little more sensitivity, compassion. So it was an extraordinary day that happened, and it changed everything. I changed my talk because that was the morning I was going to be writing, and there it was. But this beautiful animal and the five of us together, friend and enemy, hunter and hunted, and then I thought, well, what is this deer? What is this buck? And so I looked up and I came across this other story in Buddhism. And I guess it's one of the most well-known Jataka tales, the tales that the Buddha told as teaching. And Nigrodha was this magnificent stag. He had silvery horns and golden hide, and he had a herd of 500 other deer. And Sakka was another great stag, and he had 500 deer. And at one point, the king decided that he needed deer meat every day to eat. And so he had his soldiers round up these two herds of deer. And every day they would come and there would be this sailing of arrows into the stockade so they could kill a deer. One deer is all they needed, but sometimes more would be killed. And so Nigrodha had this idea that we should organize so at least it's not as painful for everyone, and we'll have a lottery. And one day will be from the Sakka tribe and one from the Nigrodha tribe. And that was working. They were losing one deer who offered themselves for the benefit of the whole herd. But then one day, this doe, pregnant, just couldn't imagine not having her child, her baby, grow and be born. And so she went to she was part of the Saka tribe, and she went to Saka, the great great stag of the Saka, and she said, "Please, can you wait so that my fawn will be born, and then I will go once the fawn can live on its own." And he said, "No, the system's set. This is how we have to do it." But she went to Nagroda, and he listened to her plea, and he said, "I will take care of you. You don't have to worry. You and your fawn are safe." And so when the men came for the deer that day, it was Nagroda who offered himself in the doe's place. And the king, who was in awe that he would make this sacrifice, especially for a doe from a different herd, said he would spare the life of Nagroda as well as the doe. But Nagroda said, "I don't want you to spare my life if that means another will die in my place." And the king was moved by this stag's compassion, and he announced he would put an end to all deer hunting altogether. And Nagroda said, "No, if this means that you will hunt another animal in our stead." And the king was so moved, loving kindness, he promised to put an end to hunting. And from that day forward, there was no hunting in his kingdom. And then the Buddha explained that in a previous life, he was Nagroda, and Devadatta, his brother-in-law, was Saka, and Ananda was the king. I love that. Ananda was the one who was learning. So I've been, for some reason, the death of this buck hit me very hard. I cried enough yesterday, so I wouldn't cry while I was giving this talk. But there's like this question for me, like, why? I don't really understand. I don't know. You know, I brought the hunter to the buck, right? And I thought I was doing a good thing in a way that he would take him for meat. But I feel like somehow I am responsible. It's like I feel pierced by this buck's death. And I just feel also blessed that I had this intimate contact with him. And I guess that experience really put me close to my own suffering somehow, and just suffering in the world in a way that, like an arrow that pierces you. And I really hope that this buck, like this buck's sacrifice, can help me heal. Maybe he can help all of you heal. Because isn't he also the Buddha?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.